You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske, and Sam Gardner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I'm talking with Stefan about apps on prescription, paid by the government. We are mentioning a couple of different resources for the background here, and you can find all of these as long and lots of other content on theeffectivestatistician.com, so check out all the different resources on the homepage. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library and many, many more things. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI and become a member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician, and today I'm talking with Stefan Walzer. Hi Stefan, how are you doing?
Hi Alexander, very well. What about yourself?
Very good. It's a rainy, dark December morning.
Yeah, it's not raining here, but it's still quite darkish, I would say.
But we are talking about a topic that is pretty new, and I think it will be really important for the future. And in other areas, I think this digital landscape has already kind of reached many different things in our healthcare, regulated healthcare environment. It's something pretty new. I think that's because of all the regulations, there's always a little bit of a slower move here. But before we dive into this, let's introduce yourself first. So what's your background? How did you get into healthcare?
Yes, perfect. Thank you, Alexander. I mean, thanks also for inviting me to The Effective Statistician. I mean, I'm actually an economist. I mean, I like to have statistical courses long time ago, obviously. But from background, I'm an economist. I have a PhD in health economics and also a postgraduate diploma in clinical trials. So I think that was probably the kind of path already a bit into health and health economics. But at the end of the day, it was really, I think, the kind of path that I was starting in consultancy, where I was working for the pharmaceutical industry for medical device parts. But I was doing quite a lot of modeling. So health economic modeling, in those days, it was primarily for the UK, because I think they were always at the forefront, right? Before I was then moving, let's say, into more, probably also more strategic roles when I went into the industry. And since now roughly already 10 years, I'm basically running my own company. We're focusing on the German speaking markets, and here really broadly for pharmaceuticals, for medical devices. And obviously, I think the topic we're in today as well for digital health applications, even though I have to say DIGAS, which is I think today the topic, is just one part of the digital health solutions, right? There are also other parts of digital solutions which might not be part of the definition of a DIGA, but that's also what we, for example, cover.
Interesting. Yeah. So you just already mentioned the word DIGA, which is a an abbreviation for a German word. So what is a DIGA actually?
Yes, I think actually very good question at the end of the day. And I think you also, I think, pointed out already, it is an abbreviation of a German word, right? It's digitale Gesundheitsanwendung in German, which I think it can be translated in a way like a digital health application. But that last word, the application, is sometimes a bit misleading, right? It's not always about apps. I mean, we always have a lot of discussion and question. So do we need to have an app in order to be a DIGA? Which is not the case, right? I mean, there's a definition and an app could be, but you could, for example, as well, let's say develop your DIGA as a let's say, using a browser function or something, right? That you can just access it via a browser. But at the end of the day, I mean, we have different, let's say, parts of the definition. I think the very first one is coming from the regulatory side, which is you need to have a CE certification, obviously, and it needs to be a medical device class 1 or 2A. That's already very important, because at the end of the day, depending a bit which digital health solution you have, you might also end up in a class 2B, right? Which is then not or no more the DiGA pathway to get reimbursement in Germany, but that is then another pathway which leads directly through the Joint Federal Committee in Germany, the GBA, which is then a method evaluation, not part of our discussion today. It's too complex and complicated, I think.
Okay.
That's the first one, right? So it's just class 1 or 2A. So you need to tick that box. If that is ticked, then the second point is...
Let's stop there for a moment. Well, so what is class 1 and class 2A?
I mean, let's say, to make it really simple, I mean, it basically just says that the risk classification is quite low, right? I mean, it can basically not harm the patient, to make it very simple, right? There are very specific definitions of that. I'm not a regulatory expert, but I mean, there are very specific definitions, and that's basically where you can then classify that. I mean, the more you're going up, so 2B and 3, that is basically where you, I don't want to say that you can, or let's say you do automatically harm patient. I mean, that's not the case, right? It's same when we speak about drugs, right? There are side effects and complications maybe, but that's not saying that you're harming patients, right? But there's a given risk behind. And that's also, I think, what you need to take into consideration when you think about risk classes for medical devices. So the lower the risk, in a way, obviously, the more you have then the kind of definition of a risk class 1 or 2A.
Okay, so if I think about medical devices that are more risky, would be kind of stents or things like these,
exactly.
more invasive stuff, and not something that is, you know, a browser or an app or things like these kind of things. Yeah,
in general, yes. But I think here we need as well to keep an eye on. I think the more you would, for example, go into artificial intelligence or so, where you say you have a program which might have an impact and an effect on the, let's say, on a recommendation, what to do with the patient, right? In terms of treatment decision, the more it also goes up in terms of risk class, right?
Yeah.
Because automatically you just say there might be an effect and an impact on the patient. If it's rather something like, you know, you're calculating maybe a probability of, I don't know, of a progression, where you just say, please go to your doctor and get an appointment, and the doctor will further check, then there's always that, let's call it intermediate, right, which is the physician, before the next treatment step arises. And that brings, obviously, the risk class again a bit down.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about what would be aims of such applications. So I think there's a couple of different areas that this could play in. It could be kind of help or maybe even provide diagnostic decisions. I guess it can help with monitoring the severity of the disease or side effects or things like that. It can help to, you know, as you just said, you know, trigger certain kind of monitoring discussions with physicians. Are these kind of the typical areas where these things would play a role?
I think you have probably already mentioned a lot of those areas. Absolutely. I think monitoring, I think, is the first thing where probably everybody has in mind, right? I mean, if you have a disease and you can basically, let's take the simplest case, right? I mean, we all know the Apple Watches, right? And they can now as well, let's say, collect your information on, I think, on blood pressure or on
heart rate.
Yes, heart rate, exactly. So, I mean, if you take that and could, for example, combine it with an algorithm which could calculate, let's say, a risk for a heart failure or for a myocardial infarction, etc., this would be as well an application, right? Where you just say there's collection of data, then there's a digital component of it which is calculating. That's the algorithm behind. And then there might be an alert, right? Which could be on your watch, which could be with the caregiver, which could be even with physician, which might be a bit tricky when you're speaking about DiGAs. But this is the kind of ultimate, let's say, pathway. You're totally right. I think not to forget, I think, and we have quite a good number there, is, for example, also psychoeducation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's very clear, I mean, what to do, in which ways, etc. And there we have already as well, let's say, different DIGAs available. Also in the insomnia area, for example, and a couple of other quite interesting areas where we also know that there's quite good development. But in general, you're totally right. I mean, how you described it, I think this is probably the areas where most of the developments, at least I think, are currently being done for DIGAs and beyond DIGAs.
So it could also be that a DIGA is not only the diagnostic and kind of measuring, but it could also be some form of intervention. Yeah. So that it's kind of, as you say, psychoeducation, or maybe there's some intervention in terms of insomnia, things like this. I have no clue about this area, but kind of, you know, plays music that helps you get asleep faster, or kind of, you know,
yeah,
is helps with the lighting in the room, whatsoever. So there's all these other kind of things that you could think of as well. Yeah,
exactly. No, absolutely. And I mean, I think the most prominent one is, I think, also, let's say, working in the area of depression, for example, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you just covered that, right? I mean, it is, or it could also be a therapy, right? It always depends, however, what the underlying, let's say, rationale is, right? I mean, we always need a scientific basis for that. But I think as long as you could, for example, translate, a therapy which can be, let's say, mimicked in a way from a physical person, so from a physician or a therapist, into a digital application, then it could also be a therapy, absolutely. I mean, everything else is probably more, I mean, we need to be careful with the word monitoring, right? Because monitoring might go already into a class 2B, or at least could not, could end up in a tool for the physician, which is just, in the definition of DIGA, it needs to be used by the patient, right? If it's rather a physician tool, which could be seen with most of the monitoring, then it's no more a DIGA as well, right? So that's also where I'm a bit, let's say, careful to use the word monitoring. But in general, I agree with you.
Okay. And now there's one really interesting thing, and that is the kind of German-specific situation, which I think is pretty unique. So what's so unique about Germany?
Yes, I think, interestingly, I mean, we even have, let's say, press coverage across various countries, also the US, right? The US is also looking now into Germany. How do they really implement digital health solution? I think this week there was even a kind of a title in the Swiss newspaper, watch out to Germany. They are basically overruling and getting up to speed in terms of digital health. I mean, which was very interesting to see when you just compare it 2 years ago, right? I think it was at least seen a bit difficult. But just coming back to your question, what is so unique, right? I think it has probably different components. I think, first of all, I think the most important thing, and that is probably what I would say the system has also learned from the pharmaceutical process, I would say, is that the products could be available when, in this way, it's registered within the so-called DIGA registry. So it's basically one pathway. You go to the so-called BfArM, which is the registration body. You basically show them what you have in your hands, and they apply then the rules, so especially the definition for the DIGA, right? I mean, if that all applies and you have as well at least a kind of proof of concept, I would say, for the DIGA, then you would be included at least preliminary into that DIGA registry. And from that moment, the DIGA is basically included in that registry. It could be used by the patient. And importantly, it's even being reimbursed by the insurance funds. And I think this is probably the very unique situation.
Yeah.
But that's the first one, right? Because you could just say, first, it's preliminary. But secondly, I mean, I just said it's proof of concept. Why the hell only approve, right? I mean, that is like this, right? It's just too simple in a way. No. What then basically happens is that the BfArM and the system basically allows the DIGA companies to, let's say, develop within a time frame of 12 months to develop then the evidence. So it's basically really, let's say, the evidence to prove your concept in a way, right? The proof of concept. But yeah, while you already have reimbursement, and I think this is the very unique, I think, situation as well, right? You have, and I would say a bit more than an idea, you have shown that it works, then you can go on the market, you get already the money from the health insurance company. At the same time, you basically, you develop your evidence in order then to be registered finally permanently into the DiGA registry. I think this is probably the kind of combination of the uniqueness.
That is really, really interesting because it basically means that you can gather real-world evidence data during these 12 months of preliminary approval to collect much more kind of information on how it works, yeah, user experience, all kind of different things to go back to the regulator. So that makes it very unique also from a, and very different to a pharma approval, yeah, where it only after you have proven that it works, it's safe and it's high quality, that it gets reimbursed, yeah.
I think I would say exactly, but what you need to keep in mind, real-world evidence could be a component of your evidence package, right? You need to be sure, depending on what you submit, obviously, the BfArM will as well, or let's say needs to agree with you on the final evidence package. Yeah. And that needs, normally it needs still to be, let's say, comparative, right? It could be in a real world, let's say, area. That could happen, right? But I think it's important that they want to have as well the evidence, obviously in a German environment, within the 12 months, which is sometimes a bit difficult. We had discussions, for example, on let's say in the area of asthma. And obviously, if you think about those kind of events, what you see there, exacerbation, et cetera, they don't really happen so often. If they happen, it's very severe, right? But if they don't happen, then it's basically a more rare event. So you need much more a patient there. So I think, I mean, you're better, let's say, to say how you do the power calculation, but how could you really do that in 12 months, right? In order, and also at the same time, to not have, let's say, hundreds of different sites, study sites based in Germany, right? Because you need to have German data. Why? Because the DiGA is basically communicating with the patient, right? So you have it in written or a video or whatever else in German because it's German patients. So that's also one of the difficulties, right? If you have a proof, for example, by randomized controlled trial somewhere in the US or in France or somewhere, you need to as well to prove to the BfArM that this is really transferable into the German context with a lot of discussion, especially at the very early beginnings. And a lot of times it's rather more, you know, that language validation. I think the BfArM has also, let's say, changed. I think they're getting a bit more pragmatic, used to the cases, but it's not that easy. But I agree with you that it's at least very unique. But that's, again, going back to what we had a couple of minutes before on the risk class, right? The lower the risk class, the less likely you basically harm patients. And so the more you could basically as well go with such a pathway.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that means that by the way you get into the registry the first time, you need to have a very, very clear plan already. Yeah, so to make sure that you can meet the 12 months timeline. Figuring it out thereafter is probably a bad idea because 12 months can pass by pretty fast. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's also what the BfArM tells when you, for example, go into consultation, which is also a possibility, right? You could even discuss with them in detail the protocols, for example, right? But I'm totally with you. I think the time when you are part of the DiGA registry, so that you basically launch in a way, right? That's where the latest your DiGA study, if you need to prove that, needs to start, because 12 months is really a short time period at the end of the day. Important, maybe a quick asterisk in there, you could, let's say, prolong it during that period, not at the early start, right? You cannot just say, you know, I take 6 months longer, please approve it. That's not possible. You need to plan for the 12 months, meaning at month 12, the data and the new application needs to be with the BfArM, right? Which does not mean January to December is the trial, then you do the analysis, and then you do the report, then you submit. No. This needs to be all put into those 12 months. But you can expand it for a first 3 month period and for a second, 3rd month period as well in exceptional cases. So you need to explain why, right? Mm-hmm. Difficulty of recruitment. I mean, COVID, is probably already an old story, but you know, those kind of things, right? I mean, sorry, I mean, we have already, I don't know, 80% recruited, we need another 3 months. That's not an issue, right? But I mean, you need to plan it ahead of time. And that's, I think, very important with you as well, you said.
Yeah. So when we dig a little bit deeper into the requirements, mm-hmm. So if I think about a diagnostic tool, mm-hmm. then I basically need to show how this diagnostic tool works in real life versus some kind of gold standard.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it has probably different components here, right? Because it's digital, you have also all of those IT requirements, which is quite a lot, right? I mean, IT security, IT safety, I mean, data security, whatever else. I mean, it is quite a lot of stuff what as well the company needs to think about. And some of this is also unique to Germany. I mean, we have seen that with a couple of companies, they had already product in other countries and they had still to change it, at least in some components, in order to meet the BFAM requirements. I think that's the first part, right? The second part is then, I mean, if you then have your product, you need to as well think obviously and to show how this obviously compares against the German, let's call it standard of care, mm-hmm. which is maybe a bit different also to the pharmaceutical area, right? Where you a lot of times have another drug or so, right? I mean, currently you could probably, and in some cases really just say, I mean, look, those patients don't have a digital, let's say, application yet. So we just compare it against patients who do not have that. So it's basically kind of placebo, right? What you obviously as well need to think and have in mind, I think that's also, I think, where you probably as well have a good background. I mean, a lot of times I think companies are also running crossover trials, right? Because that helps as well in terms of recruitment, right? I mean, how do you want to, let's say, satisfy a patient if they say, yes, I agree, I attend, or let's say I jump into the study and I see, obviously, because you can apply in it, right? I mean, you cannot just have a placebo DIGA. You have either the DIGA or nothing. So what is the incentive then for the patients who do not get the DIGA to stay in the study, right? So that is why a lot of times that crossover comes as well into effect. But you could also just say we only analyze the first part, right? But that's as well a discussion then with the beef farm, also from a methodological perspective, how you best do that, right?
Yeah, there's with crossover trials, you can have all kinds of different complexities. Yeah. And one of the safe things is just looking into the first period. And have that powered appropriately that maybe you don't need the second period.
I would go with that, yes.
Okay, very, very good. There's a lot of references already that you can use to learn about these. And also, which is nice, lots of these are provided also in English, so not only in German, also from the German BfArM, from the German regulator, you can learn about these things on the respective homepages, and we'll link to these in the show notes. There's one other resource that I would like to mention as well, and that is Stefan's podcast that he is also running now for some time. Tell us a little bit about this and what's the target audience and what's usually the content?
Yes, thank you, Alexander. I think the podcast was basically born out of the idea that, I mean, we got a lot of times, let's say, obviously very similar kind of questions around market access, reimbursement, pricing, health economics, right? And a lot of times people as well just said, you know, we trust you because we know you already a long time, but it would still be good to have maybe the opinion of one of the other stakeholders within the system, right? And that is where we, let's say, started quite, lower based in a way, and where we had the first discussions with different experts, right? It's always in the area of market access, health economics, pricing. It's not always, let's say, in Germany or in Switzerland, Austria, where we have obviously, our heads on. I mean, we have also, for example, upcoming episodes for digital health applications in the US. We'll have a kind of discussion with the Canadian expert where we just compare the upcoming EU joint HTA assessment with the Canadian system and when they integrated that. But we have obviously as well, because we have just discussed the DIGA pathway, we have as well had, for example, discussions with responsible persons from the BFAM, which are just currently in the, let's say, making, but also, for example, with the current head of the arbitration board of the DIGAS. I mean, he's also the former head of the AMNOG arbitration board, but I think that you can probably already get quite some parts out of it. We have as well more general episodes, which is maybe going to negotiations more, where I think you can as well get quite a lot out of it, even though that a lot of that experience when we had the discussions is based on our drug experience. But the frame, when you have a look on the DIGA price negotiation frame and the frame for the drugs, is very similar in Germany, right? So, I mean, just watch it out. I mean, the name is very simple, MAP, MAP, Market Access Podcast, and it covers a lot of different areas, but especially obviously for market access, health economics pricing.
Yeah. So for all the statisticians that more work in the later phases of the development and want to learn a little bit more about how to launch a product, not just getting it approved, but actually bringing it to patients and making sure that it's covered through the different systems around the world. Check out this podcast to learn more about these kind of things and listen to stakeholders that live and breathe these kind of systems. Thanks so much, Stefan. That was awesome to have a discussion about digital health applications, specifically to Germany. And I'm pretty sure this topic will be becoming a more hot topic in the future as well. There's so many possibilities and opportunities. And as you said, there's a lot of other countries that look into what is happening in Germany. And potentially, copy and adapt from Germany. So that will be interesting to see in the future. Any final learnings that you would give to the listener?
Yes, I think very important, probably whoever wants to come into, let's say, the German DIGA world in a way, not only, I think that's quite clear, plan your, let's say, submission in your market launch. It sounds so simple, but probably consult early on the BfArM. You can even do that in English. I think you just mentioned that. That's a big difference to the drug area as well, right? You can submit your consultation request in English. You have the consultation meeting in English, which is a lot of times much easier, especially when we maybe think about companies from outside of Germany. That's the very first and important one. Listen carefully what they tell you. I think when you run your clinical trials, I think it is probably for, I guess, for most of your listeners as well, probably call it a no-brainer, that you have a protocol, a statistical analysis plan. Exactly. You're laughing. We had companies where we needed to explain a clinical study report. But please, this is mandatory. I mean, how else could an institution really check what you have done and interpret the results carefully? So these are probably the two most important learnings, I would say. One, go and listen to the BfArM, the institution there. Speak with them. Discuss with them. And the second part, if you then run or if you have run already your study, please have your documentation up and ready. I think those are probably the most important things.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks so much, Stefan. And stay tuned to learn more about market access through his podcast.
Thank you, Alexander.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.